Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's Adam's Family Retrospective Series.
Time for some family bonding, whether you like it or not.
Hosted by Stuart.
Some called him inhuman leave.
Arnie.
You strike me as a very weird young man.
And Brock.
Damn, it's good to have you back.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Don't let you frighten me.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Showtime!
Today we're talking about The Addams Family.
The real one.
Yeah, the one we all know.
The one from the 60s? I mean, I think that's still the best known one.
Really? I don't think so. I think...
To be discussed.
Starring Angelica Houston, Raul Julia, Christopher Lloyd, Dan Hedaya, Christina Ricci. Directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. This is Brock, co-host of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is the altogether ooky host of Now Playing, Arnie.
Well, as we just mentioned, this is probably the Addams Family that people of our generation really know and think of as the Addams Family. I know I watched the show when I was little, but when this movie came out and after I saw it, this is the family that I think about every single time someone talks about the Addams Family.
This movie holds a fond place in my memory that has nothing to do with the quality of this movie. It has nothing to do whether it's a good movie or not. It is the first movie I saw as a midnight movie. They had a Thursday night screening back when those kinds of things were a rarity, and I was still a teenager living under my parents' roof and had made friends at Showbiz Pizza where I was working and got invited to, like, wow, stay up really late and go see a movie, like, drive myself to the theater and everything. It was all very new. When this came out, I felt like I was a kid, and so the fact that we showed up and the place was packed and they were acting like it was the Rocky Horror Picture Show, my memory is they were like throwing popcorn and snapping and doing dances and all of that. It was just such a good time, and I just felt the freedom of, like, now, well, maybe I'm not an adult, but I'm out from under my parents' thumb, and it just felt so great. I haven't seen the movie since, until this week, but I always did cherish this movie for that reason.
I remember you telling me about that midnight movie experience, and I didn't believe you. And to this day, it still sounds so weird, because Springfield didn't have midnight movies. There just weren't midnight showings. You told me back then there were cosplayers. I'm like, for this movie, there were cosplayers for the Addams Family? I mean, the fact that it was this movie, I mean, I would have believed it for Hook. But I don't know that I would have believed it for this movie, and that it was at midnight, and it was full of excited people, and I think you told me they were throwing Addams Family cereal?
It probably was the popcorn, but I did receive a box of complimentary Addams Family cereal, and so maybe it was the cereal, I don't remember.
But I believe you now. It still seems really freaking weird, though, that they would even do that, and that there would actually be people who love that show so much, that got so psyched for this movie, they're gonna break out their black monk robes and straight razors and fester it up.
Well, I mean, also, goth was kind of big then, it's kind of still big now, and a lot of goth kids that I knew in high school were drawn to this movie. It's kind of seems to me like that kind of crowd that I saw my first midnight show with, which was Rocky Horror Picture Show, around the same time this came out. I saw this one on a date. This one and Hook, I think, with the same girl. It's all kind of muddy. It didn't work out. I hope she's happy. I don't know. But
do you blame the movie?
I mean, it could be. I mean, I tried the light bulb trick afterwards to see if she would like Fester's light bulb. She did not find that funny.
No, then it wasn't meant to be.
And I have the Fester cut right now, too, right? The haircut. So anyway, this movie, I had it on VHS. I've seen numerous times since that theatrical release. But I remember this movie quite differently than you do. This one, I played this pinball machine so much that I know this movie, I think, better from the pinball machine quotes than I do from the actual movie.
Yeah, well, Arnie brings up an interesting point. It's 1991. Why the F does anyone care about the Addams Family? The one thing that I could think of, well, there was a couple things. One, it had been doing well in syndication. I mean, in Nick at Night, that never meant anything to me, but there was an audience for all of that 50s, 60s television entertainment. And so it could be rediscovered in that way. And more importantly, Batman, which proved that you could take an old TV show and an old comic and have a giant ass hit, thanks to Tim Burton. And all those things feel like they were an attempt to rekindle that, in the same way that Dick Tracy was a miscalculation to try and do the same thing the next year. Adam's Family feels like Orion Pictures' attempt to do Tim Burton and Batman.
Yeah, I definitely thought this was the most Tim Burton movie I've ever seen that didn't have Tim Burton attached to it.
Indeed.
But they did say at the time that Munsters was actually kicking Adam's Family's butt in syndication. So Adam's Family was a little bit less known at the time. Apparently a bunch of film executives were road tripping it and on the way back started singing the Adam's Family song just in the car. Everyone knew all the lyrics. The next day somebody pulled out some old cartoons, pitched a picture, and that's what it took. And they figured if we all have fond memories of it, maybe everyone has fond memories of it.
And that's a very good point, Arnie, because recently, with my children, they know the theme song down pat. They've never watched an episode of that show. They hadn't watched any of the movies until recently. And they knew this song since they were kids because it's constantly played for them now at Halloween. So that song has endured, and I read the same thing you did about those film executives, and it didn't surprise me at all because that song is so catchy and kids love it.
It's like that scene from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles where they're singing the Flintstones. That's what I envision.
Exactly.
And you say Tim Burton was not involved with this, but that wasn't the plan. The plan was, for a while, his name was on this, and they got the screenwriter of Edward Scissorhands and Nightmare Before Christmas to do a draft. And why Tim Burton didn't do this, the official reason is he had to do the Batman sequel.
Yeah, but later on in his career, he did Dark Shadows, so clearly he had this kind of thing in mind eventually, right? I mean,
well, he's doing Adam's Family right now. He's in charge of Wednesday on Netflix, so yeah, right. He had something on the mind.
There you go.
He never let it go, and we'll talk about him when we get to the animated movies, too, because he was supposed to do those as well. You can see the influence. It's obvious. I practically call this movie Beetlejuice 2. The idea of ghoulish humor and taking the macabre and making it farce is Tim Burton all over.
For sure. But you brought up something last time, I think, that also might have convinced the executives this might be the right move. Didn't that video game for Nintendo already come out before this movie?
Yeah, that was actually, believe it or not, I bought a Nintendo 8-bit system really late, basically on the recommendation of a friend that told me you got to play Fester's Quest. It's kind of the reason I bought the whole system, and I never knew that it was an Addams Family game. Like, I didn't know Uncle Fester, so it just didn't occur to me. Even them playing the theme song at the beginning of the game, I don't know why it never clicked. It's kind of pathetic, really. But I did play that game a lot, and to me, it was a great game. I talked to other people, and they're like, oh, that game sucked. But I don't know. I guess I didn't play the right Nintendo games. It was much better than the ones I had.
Well, I went back and played it again. Now, I played it back in the day, but I played it after this movie came out on your recommendation. You said Fester's Quest was a great game, and I picked it up.
Am I going to pay for this? I feel it coming. I feel that heat. You said it was great! Okay, shit.
I remember liking it at the time, okay? Mm-hmm.
You're fighting aliens, right? The whole thing is you're running around fighting an alien invasion, which sounds like a plot for the movie. If they were making an Addams Family movie, that would be like the thing, right? You make this big spectacle with space aliens.
Nothing in this game makes it feel like the Addams Family. Like, literally, they could have made a game called They Came From Outer Space and sure, then somehow got in touch with somebody who had Addams Family licensing and turned the main character into something that looked like a monk, because you're not fighting anything Addams Family-ish. Thing isn't running around with you.
Right. You wouldn't know it's an Addams Family game. That's my point. Even though they have a Calypso version of the theme song at the beginning, I just never made that connection because it's not a really heavily inferenced tie-in.
And the game is hard as hell.
I remember that.
I played it back in the day, and I don't remember it being so hard, but I had, with my Nintendo, I got those cool joysticks, because I didn't like gamepads, I liked actual joysticks, and it had like a steel base and big buttons, and auto fire, if people remember those. Yeah. And so when I played the game, I had auto fire. I loaded it up recently on an emulator, no auto fire button, and it takes like 16 shots to kill the very first alien you see. You're just sitting there, bang, 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 the whole damn time running away from things. I found the manual. The instruction manual says, recommended for play with auto fire controller. They knew they screwed this thing up with too many bullets. So I found a way to turn on auto fire, and I played it again. It's a really simple game. Once I read the manual, I did need to figure it out, but it's like, I saw a walkthrough, you can beat the game in 50 minutes if you have auto fire. I don't think you can get past level one if you're using a standard NES controller.
I don't think I ever did beat it, just for the record. I do remember it being challenging, but kind of had like a first-person mode sometimes. Mm-hmm. You'd go into like houses and stuff. I just remember thinking, for that time, and for, you know, coming from the Atari into that, like, this was as cool as home video game got.
The 3D stuff was kind of cool. The graphics were bad even for Nintendo era, though. I mean, it really... The letters that came to mind were EGA, for people who know what that means. It was really an ugly-looking game, but kind of fun. I don't know that I'd recommend spending your $40 on it. Were we back in 1989? It's worth a rental.
Okay. Well, thanks for not destroying my childhood, because to me, it's one of the best NES games ever. But probably not. I believe you. I have not gone back. And I hadn't gone back to this movie, so it was really a curiosity to see how much of those good, hazy memories were based in nostalgia and the people I was with at that time in my life, and how much was because Barry Sonnenfeld had really nailed it. This is Barry Sonnenfeld's first directorial movie. He had been a cinematographer for the Coen brothers and for Rob Reiner, but he is, when Tim Burton says no, and Terry Gilliam, I think, also said no, he says yes.
And just to let people know, Barry Sonnenfeld may not be on the tip of everybody's tongue, probably best known for Men in Black, but also one of my favorite movies of all time with Get Shorty.
Yeah, that is his best.
And just some other quirky stuff.
Wild Wild West?
Men in Black 2? Yeah, it doesn't all work, but...
Well, Men in Black 2, you really can't blame him for that. That was...
Yes, I can.
You guys talked about that on that show, but Barry Sonnenfeld, he's an interesting choice for me in that it kind of does feel like he's aping Tim Burton to the point where when we see Men in Black, when you see Get Shorty, I get his style more. But here, I kind of feel like maybe I'm not giving him enough credit for creating what's here, but what works here, I don't know how much Barry Sonnenfeld really had to do with.
And I wanted to know that. So I picked up, he wrote an autobiography a couple years ago. I picked it up to see what he had to say about this time in his life, and he agrees with you. He's like, I wasn't a director. I wasn't even a thought of mine that I'd be a director. Most cinematographers aren't good with actors. They don't know that craft. They like the technical, you know. So like for him, he was always fighting to get the shot, you know. And in fact, the screenwriter that he hired ended up walking on this movie. They hired somebody else. They got sick. He ends up shooting this movie. But it does feel like this movie is much more of a technical exercise than it is storytelling. And I think that he felt like he was really hamstrung because the producer that talked him into this said, you know, just go into production even though you don't like the script. And he brought in Paul Rudnick to try and do rewrites. But a lot of this was improvised, done on the fly, in a really messy, what sounds like a really chaotic production. As funny as you might find this movie, it was terribly unfunny to be on that set.
I read the same things as you did. I heard that Angelica Houston had problems with her costume, with her eye. They pulled back her eyes a lot.
Yeah.
I heard...
Can you imagine walking around? You agree to do a movie. They want you to have slant eyes. So they tie like thin little wires to your eyes and you're like having migraines every second because of that and can't see.
Yeah. I can, but I would have expected Spielberg to be the one doing that, because didn't he do something similar to Dustin Hoffman on Hook?
Not exactly. I believe that he manipulated the beard in the wind so that he could control every follicle. Yeah. Quite different from actually inducing migraines in your leading lady. But yeah, she got a Golden Globe nomination out of this, but a lot of pain and suffering for an Oscar winner.
Yeah, and they paired her up with Raul Julia and with the find of Christina Ricci. They got Christopher Lloyd. I mean, they cast this thing wonderfully. So even with the problems behind the screen, when you have the cast, one of the best casts that I can think of for something like this, they lucked out in that sense. Like, they have the people in front of the camera who can probably make up for any problems behind the screen. It doesn't always work that way. With, like, Will Ferrell movies, you can see sometimes it doesn't quite work. But here, I think that really helped out a lot.
Yeah.
One thing that dampened my excitement for this movie when it came out, and it still kind of holds true to this day, is other than Christopher Lloyd and Dan Hedaya, this is a cast of pretty much unknowns to me. You know, I had seen Angelica Houston in a couple of things. Raul Julia, I didn't know him from Adam when this movie came out.
I saw him in Presumed Innocent and didn't realize it was the same guy.
Come on, you didn't love Kiss of a Spider-Woman as a kid? But you know what? Here's the other thing that really made this hell. Now it seems quaint to have a $30 million budget, right? But in 1989, 1990, that's pretty much as big as it got. That was Batman's budget. That was Ghostbusters' budget. This movie was one of the most expensive ever greenlit. And Orion Pictures, the studio that was bringing it to the screen, just couldn't afford it. It's kind of ironic, but they were like an indie studio that was artist-friendly. And just as they were starting to pull themselves out of the hole, they went bankrupt. They had Dances with Wolves, Silence of the Lambs, and this film, and then it was kaput. They had to sell this to Paramount. Paramount didn't really make this movie. They sold it to Paramount halfway through production. The executive that saw the rushes said, this is going to be great, and then got fired. And the new guy that took over Paramount Pictures said, this movie is shit, and it's horrible, and thought they had really sunk a lot of money into a failure and had no confidence in this film. So they were always getting notes from executives. There was always interference. And again, this is your first film. I can't imagine what Barry Sonnenfeld was going through. It must have been hell. But it was a big hit. $100 million also sounds quaint by today's standards, but this thing broke what was considered kind of a glass ceiling back at the time. You were really something if your movie made over $100 million.
This was back when there were 10 that made over 200, exactly 10. And so the 100 million club was a good stratosphere to be in.
And that was just domestic, right? They made much more overseas too, right? So this one was a gigantic hit for the investment. And poor Orion, because I remember them from, you know, they had tons of hits before the Oscar stuff too. They had like Bull Durham, The Rotten Scoundrels, they had a whole bunch of stuff.
RoboCop.
Yeah. RoboCop. I mean, tons of good stuff.
Well, if you've seen RoboCop 3, you know how in trouble they were by this point. But yeah, big hit, but I don't know if it's a classic. I guess that's what we're here to talk about. Arnie, why don't you give him the plot of This Addams Family and we'll find out what it's all about.
Fester Addams is missing. The eldest Addams ran off 25 years ago after his brother Gomez Addams, played by Raul Julia, hit on Fester's girlfriend. Gomez is now middle-aged, married to Morticia Addams, played by Angelica Houston, and father to Wednesday, played by Christina Ricci, and Pugsley, played by Jimmy Workman. Also living with them is Morticia's mother, Grandmama, played by Judith Malina, their house servant, Lurch, played by Carol Strugan,
Twin Peaks giant,
and disembodied hand Thing, played by magician Christopher Hart. Despite his family bliss and his vast fortune, Gomez wishes for the return of his brother. This desire is a weakness that will be exploited by Gomez's lawyer, Tully, played by Dan Hedaya. Tully owes money to his loan shark, Abigail, played by Elizabeth Wilson, but Abigail's son, Gordon, is the spitting image of Fester. The trio devise a plan where Gordon will pretend to be Fester, be taken into the Addams family's confidence, then he will be able to rob them of the valuable doubloons the Addams keep hidden in a secret vault. When fake Fester arrives, Gomez is elated, but Morticia and Wednesday are suspicious of the newcomer. Soon, Fester worms his way into the family and starts to realize he enjoys it. He helps Wednesday and Pugsley with their school play and dances with Gomez. Fake Fester even starts to defy his mother's wishes to rob the family, as he likes the Addams better than he likes his foster mother. Desperate, Tully and Abigail intervene. As Fester is the eldest brother, he is sole heir to the Addams fortune. They issue a restraining order in Fester's name, banishing the Addams family from their home. Gomez, Morticia, and company must move the family into a motel. This eats at Fester, who feels guilty about betraying the Addams. More, the vault is so well hidden that the thieves cannot find it anyway. Morticia goes to confront Fester, and Abigail and Tully try to torture her until she reveals where the vault is hidden. The only problem is, Morticia likes the torture. Thing sees Morticia taken hostage and alerts Gomez, who goes to rescue her. Together, Gomez and Fester defeat Abigail and Tully, who Wednesday and Pugsley bury in the Adams backyard cemetery. And during this, Fester got electrocuted and remembered he really is Fester Adams. He was in a boat accident 25 years earlier, which gave him amnesia, and he was taken in by Abigail and named Gordon. But now he's the real Fester, back with the family, and they're all perfectly unhappy, which is just how they like it, as credits roll.
And as credits start, it should be said this movie was coming out. It was a Thanksgiving release. People would have been thinking about Christmas. I think you get with this opening sort of introduction what this movie is best at. This is an actual New Yorker Charles Adams cartoon. It was one of the more popular. A lot of people wrote in when he drew a family of weirdos dumping a boiling cauldron on a bunch of Christmas carolers. And I think they just wanted to recapture what he had done in print that they never would have dared. The TV show never went that dark.
It's a great way to open the show because not only do you have the entire family doing it, but it's an homage to it. Plus, it tells the people who are watching this, who watch TV show, this is how we're going to go with it. Right away, it tells this is how we're going to go with it. And it's really smart.
And right away, it panders to the TV crowd because the moment you see the Addams Family, in comes the classic theme. They do not waste a moment before telling people. Because to be honest, I didn't know this was a cartoon. I found out after this movie came out that there were cartoon strips. I don't even know if you call them strips. They're like the Far Side. They're single panels.
Right.
But I only knew this as a TV show. And for people like me who only knew this as a TV show, they're going to make you feel comfortable with that old theme song.
Arnie, you have gone back and seen Charles Adams' work since, though, right? You've seen some of the panels?
Yeah. I bought a book of Adams Family cartoons after seeing this movie. I don't know why, but some part of me, I guess it's because of Fester's Quest, I decided I could have a whole Adams Family phase of my teenage years.
This sounds like you. I like something. I'm buying everything.
Yeah, I ended up going with Vanilla Ice instead of Fester Adams.
Okay, then. All right. Different, whole different way.
But I do want to ask then. I mean, I assume, Brock, you also know at least a few of the drawings, some of the more famous cartoons. This thing feels to me largely held together like adhesive tape to, like this fumbling narrative. It's essentially the same thing as flipping through a Charles Adams comic strip book.
Yeah, it has a bunch of little vignettes or little jokes that are like dark punchlines to normal things that you and I would say or do, and they string them together with a very flimsy, surprisingly stupid plot. I mean, honestly, we saw this plot in that Thanksgiving special. They want the Adams's gold.
Yeah. It was Halloween, but yeah.
Sorry, and then you have the whole amnesia thing. Is he or is he not Fester? I agree with you. The best parts of this movie are moments like this where it's a funny gag or a setup that will give an Adams punchline.
Is it a problem? I don't think it would be a problem now because we're so trained to the TikTok, to the YouTube clip. You know, we like bite size. So the fact that this movie is just a series of little bite-sized jokes with a macabre punchline, maybe wouldn't bother people. But as someone that loves the art of narrative and screenwriting, I will say even then, and definitely now, it's hurtful that this movie's best moments are so fleeting and that it doesn't have great characterizations for this family.
Yes, but that said, I think what really makes the movie work in place of that is that the energy that the cast brings to this and the way they're editing it. The editing of this movie is paced in such that it keeps constantly moving. Even with a stupid plot, the pace of this thing keeps barreling. Plus you have Raul Julia's infectious energy as Gomez and Morticia Adams. She nails it every scene. And then the surprise of this kid, Christina Ricci, who nobody really knew very well at the time, if at all. I think she was maybe in Mermaids before or around this.
Yep.
And she nails it. She nails Wednesday so perfectly that those three people make this movie go. And then you have the surprise of the whole movie, which is the brilliance of what they did differently with his family, was have Thing roam around the house not being stuck in a box.
It's because they could.
Right.
I mean, this was the height of special effects back then. I remember seeing a making of back in the day. I couldn't find it to rewatch it for this, but I remember them talking about needing to find somebody who could do special hand movements sense. And they ended up going with a magician who was very dexterous, you know, probably close-up magic type stuff. Very, you know, the hand is faster than the eye type stuff. And yeah, I remember being quite impressed with the hand roaming around. But yes, this is a series of gags, and your enjoyment of this movie is going to be 100% dependent on if you find them funny. Like, there's some I find funny. Right here in the opening, I really love the clock where the mortician Gomez comes out and then he's just shoving his face in her boobs. I thought that was rather ribald and kind of amusing.
They are a sexed up couple. I mean, without a doubt, you get barely subtextual when he's chomping on that cigar, you know, when they're looking at each other. It's not a surprise she winds up being pregnant at the end of this movie. Even though they don't show anything, you can feel the lust and the sexual tension through those performances, even though it's not really their movie. This is a movie for Christopher Lloyd, but somehow Angelica Houston and Raul Julia are top billed.
Yes, but they have this sexed up thing that's not annoying. Remember when we watched that Halloween movie, every time they said, oh, tish, that's French, it was so annoying. Here, they found a way to make it really work and not be too creepy, which is ironic because the whole family is creepy and kooky and eeky. But when they do it, it really works because you believe these two people are as sex-crazed for each other, but not in a terribly stupid, over-the-top way.
Yeah, most couples that already have two kids would not be this horny, let's face it. But they are a very horny family, and I love Raul Julia in this. Again, have nothing to compare him to, but he is chewing up the scenery, slashing it up, carrying a Zorro sword around for the majority of the opening here, just in random acts of lunacy. Yes, the plot is going to surround Christopher Lloyd, but I do think this is properly billed. I think that the most screen time and the most jokes go to the Addams parents.
I heard they were considering Cher. I don't know if anybody else was considered for Gomez, but Cher was going to be Morticia, and I think Angelica Houston plays it like she is Cher. It's like, this is my one and only attempt to be that diva. It's not much of a part, is the surprising thing. She's the only one with a statue, but she doesn't really have a storyline. She's mostly reactionary, and she's mostly there to be the bombshell, and she does it well. I mean, again, she suffered greatly trying to physically alter her body to be this cartoon character, but all she really gets to do is make eyes with Gomez and joking about S&M and liking the pain of death and torture.
Yeah, she has that first bit with Uncle Knick-Knack, right? Like, She has all those kinds of lines, just like Wednesday does.
Such an obvious joke, that Uncle Knick-Knack bit.
The Uncle Knick-Knack joke we knew was coming because they're all body bags, but, you know, they all can't be gold, right? But the way they played it was, you know, she's playing it so flat, just like Wednesday, and it's kind of nice that you can see the mother-daughter thing going on. They're kind of doing some similar things, but it comes out even creepier when a little girl says it, right? Because a little girl.
But if these actors are embodying characters, there's certainly one person here playing the only role I think he's ever played. That's Dan Hedaya. If there's ever a movie where he plays a hero, let me see it, because I'd love to see him go against type.
Scumbag in Commando, Scumbag in the Cheers spinoff, Scumbag for life.
Scumbag in Alien Resurrection. I mean, just everything.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that one. But yes, he has to sort of get things in motion. We know that Gomez is mourning. He has a brother that he hasn't seen in 25 years, which is also the length of time between this movie's release and when the show went off the air, not counting that awful TV movie we reviewed last week. And so he's kind of vulnerable. Is that the reason why he can't suspect Dan Hedaya's plot? Or does he just... I came up with two theories. Either he is so in mourning about his brother that he can't see the obvious con that's happening with his lawyer trying to steal from him, or because they're a macabre family, they actually appreciate scummy lawyers that try to rip them off. They'd rather have that than a upstanding individual.
I thought he was just kind of a simpleton.
Yeah, I thought he was dense.
He just seems so into his own world. The thing about the Addams is they aren't self-aware. They don't realize that they're not like everybody else. The humor is the irony of them being a nuclear family and going is the humor of this movie is them interacting with normal people, but not acting like anything's weird about them. And so when Tully shows up and they have this big sword fight, I think Gomez is just childlike. He enjoys the playing, and so when Tully starts talking about we need $1 million for this charity in my name, he just goes with it without thinking. I just think this is a group that goes on what they feel, not what they think. I don't think they think all that much.
Sure. And so this is where we get, yeah, there's lots of gags as Tully tries to work his way into the house and gets attacked by bearskin rugs and, you know, opens a book and gusts of wind blow him around. Lots of physical comedy that I'll just go ahead and say, for me now, don't play. But I don't resent the humor not working because I feel like this thing coursing in its veins is always the energy of both the principals, these actors that are giving their all to these very thin characters, but they make it more than it is. And Sonnenfeld, as visualist, at least, he is hyper aware of placement of the camera, and it is always moving. It is always shooting across the room, going down drains. I dare say there's not a single shot that it's not in motion. You know, he worked, again, if you look at those early Coen Brothers movies, there's incredible camera work in that. He did second unit on Goodfellas, and we know Scorsese loves to play with cameras. He's taken all of that knowledge and really given this an energy. That was why he was told he was chosen for this job, that the producer just told him, look, I could get a hack to just make this work, but I'd rather have a visionary. And I think his vision helps a lot.
To the point where sometimes they speed up the camera a little bit or something that's like cartoony with the way they catch things or the shots and such. And I don't mind it at all because of the energy and the mania of the scenes, like in the sword fight scene, the sword just happens to fall into his hand. You go with it because of the energy of the actors, the scenes, everything you're talking about. So if you're not buying it now, if you're not buying into what they're giving you at this point, it's going to be a very long movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're not laughing in the first 15 minutes, turn it off.
Yeah. But I was, more or less. Again, it doesn't happen. It's not one of those uproarious comedies where you're laughing at every line and every utterance and having to rewind. It's just more like good vibes. I'm in a pretty good mood, and every now and then I chuckle when they're, you know, trying to find money for the charity donation for widows and orphans because we need more of them. Like, I like that line. There are lines that still work, among all of the other things being thrown at the wall that are just not hitting.
Did you guys expect to see Kitty like we did in the TV movie from last week? Because when Gomez does go to get the money, you hear the roar of a lion and he's like, down Kitty, down Kitty. And that's the lion that we saw poorly inserted in last week's movie.
Yeah, well, he was on the show. He was always made an appearance. You know, he scared away Don Rickles in the TV episode that had the same plot. But yes, this is exactly the same plot as the thing we ridiculed last week, right down to we're going to get a doppelganger. In this case, it just so happens that the people leaning in on Dan Hedaya have a goon son that just looks exactly like the missing Uncle Fester. Convenient or stupid? Both, I guess.
Yeah. Clumsy writing, too. It does give Christopher Lloyd something to do, right? Otherwise, Uncle Fester would be pretty much a nothing part of him just coming in, making a sly comment and leaving like Grandmama. Otherwise, Fester would have no part in this movie, right? Because what else could you do with Fester?
Otherwise, this movie would have no plot. I mean, yeah. Seriously, this is the plot of the movie, is this thievery. And you say, I believe the word you said was sloppily written. I think that there's a lot of instances of doppelgangers. It's always convenient when they do that in a movie, but it's, I guess, worse here because nobody looks like Fester Adams with that pale skin and that round face and those circles under the eyes. And so to find somebody that looks like that is perhaps a little bit more difficult than to find somebody who looked like Kevin Kline and Dave.
Christopher Lloyd, though, here is wearing a fat suit that you can sometimes see underneath the robe. Like, you can see it kind of doesn't always look right. Because he's a very thin, tall, gangly man.
Funny you should say that. Like, the director talked about the fact he was on this health kick where he only ate garlic. And so, like, he was, like, always looking over. He's like, Chris, time to do this scene. And, like, he's just popping, like, cloves of garlic all the time. I can't imagine what he smelled like. But,
thank
yes.
Thank God this isn't a Fester romance story. Could you imagine having to be the woman who's in love with Fester?
Good Lord.
The garlic eater? That sounds like an Addams Family thing. It seems like something you'd expect to see Pugsley doing is just eating garlic.
And the original script was just that this is not Fester, but that this family would end up loving him, would accept him as good enough to be Fester. That was the original thought. And it was Christina Ricci in particular who made the case to the director, no, this is a huge loophole. No one is going to like the fact that if you don't have this guy be Fester, that we haven't met Fester, that just won't work. That's why at the very last minute, they whipped Aloy. They were like, Chris, which would you rather play? How would you like to do it? And he's just popping cloves of garlic and being like, don't care. Don't care. Either way.
I only saw this movie once, and that was in theaters. And the way that they do explain at the end he's really Fester is some clunky-ass dialogue and really poorly done. And so my memory walking out of that theater is, well, that's freaking weird. He's not Fester.
Mm-hmm.
He's Gordon, and he's just staying with the family. And when the sequel came out, and there's more about Fester, I'm like, no, that's about Gordon. I did not see the sequel because I didn't think Christopher Lloyd was part of the family. So they are correct. That is a misstep.
But it might be more Charles Adams in spirit with the evilness of the comics if you go with the idea that an imposter could work as well as a family member. I mean, you could probably play with that, but it is either way. I didn't even remember this as a plot. I was asking myself before I popped in this disc, what is the story of this? I thought it was Dan Hedaya was trying to evict the family from their house. That was the only thing I could kind of remember.
No, that's Bentley from the Jeffersons.
Yeah, he is involved here. We'll get to the judge in a minute. But this plot does not matter. It is a vehicle for allowing specifically, I would say, Christopher Lloyd and Christina Ricci, and to a lesser extent, Morticia and Gomez to do their thing. Poor Pugsley. No one can be a Pugsley fan.
Here's the thing about Pugsley is for half the movie, I didn't think the actor was doing the dialogue because when Pugsley speaks, you don't see the boy's face. And so I felt like everything was ADR'd and that they were intentionally cutting around this boy. At one point, I wondered if Pugsley was going to be a mute the whole movie, too. He does not speak for a while. And then finally, you do get to see the actor speaking on camera. But it was a while in, and I really did wonder if something was wrong with the casting of Pugsley in this movie.
You call him an actor, but he's a teamster now. He got out of the acting biz. He still works in movies, like, as a chauffeur and moving things around and what have you. So, yes. Christina Ricci, of course, is still a star. She's on Yellow Jackets, the TV show, in a very memorable, ghoulish role. I think this typecaster, everything that I can think of, maybe you guys can think of an exception, but from Casper on, she was always doing variations on Wednesday Addams. She will be in this new Tim Burton show. I don't think she's playing Wednesday Addams, but I bet she's ghoulish.
I thought she enjoys this. I got the impression from all these years of interviews that she has a sensibility that fits right in with Wednesday. So maybe she chooses or kind of goes towards those kinds of roles opposed only typecast.
We did review her in a very non-Wednesday role back when we did Speed Racer.
Oh, God.
Right. That's right.
That is right. And she was wrong. Yeah, that was so wrong. So wrong. Such a weird choice there. Yeah.
And she was in Monster. Wasn't she in Monster, Charlize Theron's Monster?
Yes.
And that was not a creepy role. That was just a creepy movie, right?
It's kind of creepy to romance a serial killer, but...
I guess. All right. Fair enough.
But to your point, I just want to say, I think that she is my favorite here. She was at the time and remains my favorite Addams.
It's between her and Gomez for me. I think Raul Julia's energy in this movie is so amazing. It makes me keep wanting to watch the movie. So between the two of them, that's all I need.
Let me split the difference on that vote. Raul Julia has the energy to carry the movie, whereas Wednesday is so laconic that she's like the Spicoli of this. She's able to get the funniest lines, but you could never lay a movie on her shoulders.
What about a TV show? We'll find out.
But I love Christopher Lloyd in a lot of things. I'm a big fan of his, especially around this time. And he's one of my least favorite performers. So there you go, right?
He's at the end of it, right? Like, yes, we think of Christopher Lloyd, Taxi, Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit. But he's only a couple years away from my favorite Martian.
The Hulk Hogan movie, right? With a suburban commando, right?
This is, yes. It's amazing how he went from A-list to D-list so fast as the 80s went into the 90s. This is really, I think, his last star vehicle. And is he bad in this? I'll put it this way. If I were a very small child, I would be frightened by him. His facial expressions, the makeup that they put on him, when he's smiling, he's terrifying looking. And so in that way, he fits right in with the aesthetic.
Yeah, I think he's a good Uncle Fester. I wouldn't be frightened of him, I don't think, because he never comes across dangerous, except for the one scene where he's spinning Dan Hedaya against a wall. But I don't think he's bad here. I like the performance he's giving. I like the voice he affects to be Fester. It doesn't really sound like him. It would be very weird to see Doc Brown's voice coming out of that body. I think, much like he did in Roger Rabbit, this is one of the few times where I see him truly trying to give a performance and embody a character instead of, you know, the Dream Team, where it's just Christopher Lloyd being Christopher Lloyd as insert something here.
What he's playing essentially is this guy named Gordon who is doing what his mother says. And we will find out that Abigail is the real villain. She's the loan shark that the lawyer is in with. And once she finds out that her son looks like Uncle Fester, she's going to pass herself off as some shrink and crash the seance and try to convince, gaslight, really, the Addams family into thinking that their long-lost relative is this guy. Sonnenfeld talked about the fact that he based this all on his actual mother, and a large part of that autobiography, I didn't really read it in full, it's about the cantankerous love-hate relationship he has with his own mother, who he's joked in the press many times about wanting dead.
I have a question. I'm not eminently wealthy as the Addams family are, right? But wouldn't my accountant handle the money, not my lawyer?
It feels like one too many villains, right? Like it should just be Dan Hedaya. The fact that they have to work in Abigail is really because Sonnenfeld had to bring in this mother figure to do some kind of psychodrama and work through his Freudian complex. I agree. We don't need Abigail. We really only need Dan Hedaya. And I think Dan Hedaya is marginalized, unfortunately, in the villain role.
Yeah, because Abigail is not as good of a villain. Her German accent is far from convincing. Honestly, she's the worst thing in this movie, because you've got everybody here chewing up the scenery as she's trying to keep up, and you guys go, eh, as if she's not that bad, but tell me something worse than her then. Tell me a performance that is as uneven as hers and is as unnecessary as hers.
Well, unnecessary, I agree with you, but I think she's funny, and she's proven funny in other movies. I liked her as Roz in the 9 to 5 movie that came out a decade before. She's a skilled comedian. You should have just had her be the lawyer or something. You just need, there's too many. You have Dan Hedaya and his wife, and then you have Abigail and her son, and you needed to cut one pairing and just made it simple.
The weirdest part of that whole thing is Dan Hedaya's wife has no clue about any of this. She's going to be basically made a good person by being completely oblivious to the fact that she knows her husband's in debt. She was pressuring him to get the $1 million from Gomez because they need the money. Presumably she knows to pay off the loan sharks, but she doesn't know about the Gordon Fester plot. And so she's going to remain a good person, whereas her husband and the loan shark and Gordon, I suppose, are the villains of the piece.
But to that point, Arnie, the wife in the beginning scenes is pressuring Dan Hedaya not to lose his client, the last paying client. But I got the impression that she wanted him to do something nefarious, like steal money.
Right.
But I guess not. I guess that wasn't the truth.
No. She's not in the scene where he goes back to the office with the gold doubloons and gets roughed up. So she doesn't know that part of it. To me, she feels like the classic Tim Burton square. If you go back to a movie like Edward Scissorhands, there's all those suburbanites that at first look at Edward and are like, this is a freak. But in the end, they're like wanting him to trim their hedges and seduce him and all that. Like, she's going to end up hooking up with Cousin It, even though at the beginning here, she looks like a villain. And I think that that is the message of Tim Burton movies, is that if you give yourself to goth, even the squarest person can get kinky.
Yeah, but also she kind of is in shock when she's at the house over different things. Like, you know, she plays the classic person who's shocked by all the Addams family's stuff. And then by the end of the movie, she's one of the family because when she falls for Cousin It, she completely forgets that she's put off by anything in the house.
She's the audience point of view character. For some reason, Dan Hedaya isn't shocked by a bearskin rug that's going to growl at you, but she's still freaked out by everything. And by mid-movie, she's normalized and we, the audience, are normalized.
Well, I got the impression, Arnie, that he's been there every month getting money, so he's had lots of sword fights and lots of encounters with that rug.
Right.
So, right.
And because Dan Hedaya has seen that there's this bookcase that leads to all these gold doubloons, it is Fester's job to pretend to be the brother and to go down into the depths. We get sort of a Tim Burton-ish roller coaster ride from slide to gondola to family fortune. He gets really a tour of the underbelly that should be a lot of fun from an art direction standpoint. Looks a little clunky now.
It seemed like they were trying to spend some time. Like the opening credits, just like a bunch of smoke with funny writing. It kind of felt like they were padding a little bit here. I didn't really care for this at all.
But you want to see the house, right? Like, it's a part of the character. Even in the TV show, there was so much of the bric-a-brac on the walls and all that just caught your eyes.
Their house is a museum when you come out.
Right, exactly. So it seems right that we would want to explore all the rooms, but maybe a little disappointing, the rooms in this case. But the point is that once they get down into the vault, what Gomez keeps down there, not only is the money, but these old family films, you know, Super 8 stuff, where we realize that their falling out was over Siamese twin, Flora and Fauna, that they essentially, Gomez, out of jealousy, drove his brother away.
I thought that was a clever joke, though. Earlier in the movie, he sees pictures of Flora and Fauna, but you don't know they're a two-headed Siamese person until later. So that was a nicely set up joke.
Mm-hmm. And they will eventually attend the party that's meant to send Fester away, because Fester's positioned himself as only being on vacation from the Bermuda Triangle. He claims he spent all of this time. I think Morticia and Gomez says they honeymoon there, but he goes to this place that supposedly no ship returns, and that's where he's going to, and it leads to a big party scene with lots of dancing.
The Mamushka. Now, did you guys see the theatrical cut? Or literally, it's called the More Mamushka Cut.
Yeah, I heard about this. I watched the original cut.
Yeah, I heard that there was a long dance sequence. It still feels long to me, but one that didn't play to test audiences, and they cut it down. So what did we miss?
Just more dancing between Fester and Gomez. The theatrical cut actually has an extra scene. When we cut away from the Mamushka and we get to see Dan Hedaya talking to the loan shark and saying, I've got a plan, I've got this under control, and then he leaves the house, you don't see that scene in the More Mamushka cut. Instead, you get about 2 full minutes of Mamushka.
Too much Mamushka.
Which doesn't sound like much, but believe me, when you're watching it, that's a lot of Mamushka.
Yeah, particularly when it doesn't really serve any narrative point. If there's something going on in the narrative, if there's something that I'm watching and enjoying in the character interplay, it's that this fake Fester is starting to endear himself and fall in love with this family that he wants to rip off. That particularly because Wednesday and Pugsley need help pulling off their school pageant, Bloodfest. He provides those prosthetics, the sort of Monty Python, just a flesh wound kind of gags that I remember really playing well to the theatrical audience and are still pretty funny.
It's a great scene. It's such a fun scene. And that's the scene of all of this that just hysterically fun to watch.
It's legitimately the only scene from this movie I remembered coming back. I couldn't recall anything except them standing there spraying the audience with blood from their dismembered limbs like watermelon at a Gallagher show. So it's a great gag, and you get to see this Gordon Fester guy is becoming more into the family, because he was supposed to skip that play and rob the vault, and he instead skipped robbing the vault to go make sure that they had a good play.
Let me ask you this. If they made the Mamushka the instance that Fester lost his amnesia and then be torn with the mother that raised him or whatever found him and being pulled in two directions, because that's where it kind of feels like he's being pulled in two directions. But if he actually had a coming to of, I think I am Uncle Fester here, that would have played so much better.
It probably would have, but I don't know why he would even consider still robbing the Adams if he did know he was Uncle Fester. You know, he doesn't have anything in it for him. He wasn't a child when found is the thing. He was a young adult when found. Christopher Lloyd was in his early 50s when this was made. And so it would be like a 27-year-old would not have the same allegiance to a foster mother that a 2-year-old would have to a foster mother. But I do like your instinct that it should be earlier, that he starts to come to grips with it. It should be part of the movie, basically. There should be something in this movie that tells us, Maybe he's having dreams of things only Fester would know or something like that. There could be ways to do that and make it feel organic.
It's the opposite. It's all these things he's supposed to know he doesn't. And so, again, the family has to be convinced by the shrink. They're displacing all of this guilt that he isn't a fake. You could stick with the original plan. You could, but I agree. You need to establish where Fester is. You could go the other way and say that fake Fester finds the corpse of real Fester, and we know that he's dead or something like that inside the house, that he died a long time ago. But you do need to have a twist. I do think from a screenwriting standpoint, as we're nearing the end of Act Two, we need to resolve the idea about all of this and, yeah, just give Christopher Lloyd more to play with than he really does. It does become sort of monotonous, all the scenes of guilt that he has throughout the rest of this movie. But it's at this party where Wednesday overhears their plots and is convinced that this man that she was starting to trust is in fact the imposter and runs away. And the family, in trying to obtain her, by the time they get back to the house, they've been locked out. The lawyer has conspired with the judge that lives across the way, that they're always breaking his windows with golf balls, to give custody of the house to fake Fester.
And at this point in the movie, after the party, I'm ready to leave too. I'd drive away with the Addams family and be done. We're 75 minutes into this movie, and we're about to hit a real dry spell now, as Fester and Dan Hedaya and the Loan Shark own the house, and we get a very dated, Zoomers don't know, Millennials, do you remember Sally Jesse Raphael?
The red glasses. I never even watched her. She was a minor talk show host. She was not a Donahue, an Oprah, even a Maury.
She's very much of this time, and don't they also have pictures of Barbara Bush and President Bush at the school earlier in the movie, and Jane Pauley. All of these people are very early 90s. But Arnie, I agree with you for the most part, but two of the lines that I laugh out loud at are in this sequence when they're at the motel, one of which is my favorite line in the movie is, this is made of real Girl Scouts. That's a line that was in the trailer, and it's still funny today. And then the other one was, we had to get going, Gomez, and he says, and he just almost throws it away. Gomez says, and Miss Gilligan? Mm-hmm. It just made me laugh. Oh my God. Perfect, perfect line reading by Raul Julia.
And it's nice because Gilligan came out the same year as the Addams Family.
You need to have a moment where all is lost. You need to have a feeling that the Addams Family are on the rocks, at least. They lost their house. They're living in a motel. They're having to make money for the first time. And what it is that they just needed to do this a little bit better. I don't think they needed to cut it out, Arnie. I just think it's not particularly funny that thing ends up working for FedEx. You know, like that felt more like product placement than an actual gag. And the lemonade stand was good, but Morticia going to work at a, you know, what looks like a daycare or maybe a preschool and, you know, demystifying fairy tales. It's just the kind of gag that writes itself. It's just not particularly clever.
They took the joke straight from the pilot episode of The Addams Family, where Morticia's complaining about violence in children's books, where those evil kids push the nice witch into the oven.
And again, this movie, there might be lulls. This might not be your favorite part, but I do think there are funny lines throughout. I was amused when she goes to the headhunter and, you know, is asked, what are your skills? She's like, witchcraft and sorcery and all that. And she's like, puts it down as liberal arts. I mean, that's just, as someone with a liberal arts degree, I appreciate that dig. But anyway, yes. So let's fumble to some kind of climax. For reasons I don't understand, Morticia decides to wander back and plead her case to fake Fester and ends up on the torture rack.
Because the whole thing is, Fester knew the combination to the safe. He knew which book to pull in the secret bookcase, but there's like 24 chains hanging from the ceiling and they keep pulling the wrong one and get in a water torture thing instead of the vault. They want Morticia to tell them, which chain do you pull? And she just wants them to pull that chain on the torture rack a little harder for her. And these days, I think they'd play that even more kinky. You know, they kind of hint at the S&M-ishness of it back then, that she's not enjoying it. But I think these days, they would really be playing that up in a live action one that, you know, in the day of 50 Shades of Grey, you can be a bit more open with your kink jokes.
I'm looking at you, Sherry Moon Zombie.
You
better be bringing it with that Munsters. We want to see you on the pole again.
But Gomez comes back for one last sword fight because Thing was able to Morse code, hey, Morticia's in trouble. And of course, Fester here has to make his choice. And a gun is pulled. That's the one thing I guess the Atoms can't stop. They can take the torture rack, but they can't take a bullet.
He wins the sword fight, but he, you know, a sword is no match for a gun, I think is the point.
So it's Fester who is able to save the day. All of these books we've seen have the properties of whatever is said in it.
Gone with the Wind produces wind.
Sun Also Rises, Sunrise.
Yep, he gets Hurricane Irene.
Some pretty shoddy special effects that lead me to think this was the end of the production and they didn't know how to end this movie. They had already decided, the cast had already turned on the director and said, you will make fake Fester the real Fester. And I think they threw out a much more graphic ending that would have been playing into that. And instead, yeah, had Abigail and Tully thrown into graves.
One of the funnier lines here, where Pugsley says, are they dead? And Wednesday says, does it matter? I mean, that's both true for the audience. They're out of the film. It doesn't matter if they're dead. And it's also very macabre because they're going to start burying them.
Right. Yeah. And we get an epilogue at Halloween, of course. That's the, you know, if we started at Christmas, it's right that we end on another holiday season. And we see that Pugsley is dressed as Uncle Fester. He has accepted his uncle back into the fold by emulating him. I always laugh that Wednesday is a homicidal maniac looking like everybody else. Margaret is there with Cousin It. And Morticia is knitting. And the end stinger is, I guess the setup for the next movie is that she is making baby clothes for One on the Way.
And the Addams Family will get that much bigger.
Yeah. Do you guys find it at all interesting that Cousin It sounds like Beaker from the Muppets, though?
He always kind of did, but what shocked me is he's played by Malachi from the Children of the Corn movie.
What I liked about this one was Cousin It didn't have a hat on. Just like Thing was running around the house because they can with special effects, they didn't need to have the hat to cover the face of the actor playing It with the grass skirt body thing, right? They actually saw the whole head of Cousin It first time.
But we would be remiss if we didn't talk about this abomination that comes right in the credits.
Abomination? This was a hit!
I don't know how! It was like Hammer released a video. They used it to promote this movie. It was the second single off Too Legit to Quit. If you are rapping to the Addams Family theme, you are not legit and you need to quit.
It's Adam's groove. They do what they want to do, say what they want to say, live how they want to live, play how they want to play. Come on.
Yeah, go on. Because they dance how they want to dance, and what are those lyrics in between? The Addams Family. I still don't know what the lyrics are. I looked them up before this episode for recording.
They dance how they want to dance, kick and they slap a friend. Addams Family.
What does that mean, kick and slap a friend? What does that even mean?
It means they'll kick you and they'll slap you and you're the friend. Like the way he'll cut Tully up with a sword.
Like the Mamushka.
Okay. It's a bad lyric. It's a bad song.
It is a terrible... I'm convinced it was the thing that brought down Hammer. Like Hammer was riding high and this song is so terrible that you just can't stand by him. And
it's the third Hammer song in the movie, too. It rolled up playing Too Legit to Quit.
I noticed.
In this one, I found it very self-congratulatory that at the end of Adam's groove, he's like, Adam's Too Legit. Adam's Too Legit. No, that's your other song.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, though, we were all not buying what Hammer was selling because he dropped the MC also.
He had that cartoon, too, where he's flying around with talking shoes. He had really sold out. He had really boasted. It had all gone to his head. And this, I think, is further proof that he was just cashing checks from people that he should not have gotten involved with. This hurt his... and he won the Razzie. Case in point, worst song for that year. Worse than the Vanilla Ice song from Cool as Ice. Worse than Iggy Pop's contribution from Freddy's Dead. But this rightfully is the worst.
It truly is. It was his last top 10 single in the States, which means he still had hits. Maybe he's big in Belgium. And the thing that's funny about you saying he's cashing checks is he would lose every penny of that as he would go completely bankrupt. He may be cashing the checks, but he wasn't putting them in the bank.
Well, I mean, it dried up is what he thought he could live high on the hog forever. And I think he will find in the Addams family will find that success can be fleeting.
Yeah, I remember seeing them on SNL doing both those songs because I was watching SNL the week, and he actually had the two kids introduce him and when he did the Addams Family song. Like, they were up past their bedtime.
You should check out the music video. Raul Julia is sword fighting with Hammer, and they've got Thing high-fiving Hammer. They've got the cast of the movie deeply involved in this video.
Thriller it is not.
Yeah, indeed. So, Stuart, Arnie, do you recommend The Addams Family? Stuart.
Okay. Musically, I went old school. I'm not doing that Hammer shit, so... It's clumsy and amusing, imposter plot confusing, the gag's not always fusing, this Addams Family... They try to be Tim Burton, and that's not always working. And Hammer's rap is certain to fail musically. And yet I won't get preachy. It's Peanuts drawn by Nietzsche. And thanks to Christina Ricci, a good time's had by me. In the end, mild recommend.
Nice. Arnie.
It's a not recommend to Adam's Groove, even though I do like most MC Hammer, but it's a slight recommend for this movie. The thing is, SNL is a great comparison for this, because like an episode of Saturday Night Live, you've got a whole bunch of sketches, and some are going to work, and some aren't. Sally, Jesse, Raphael feels like one they do after 12:30 in the morning, when they're just trying to wrap it up, and the Is It Made From Real Girl Scouts feels like it's one right after the monologue. So, it's all over the map with a very uneven plot. I do think that a comedy needs to clock in right at 90 minutes, and coming in at 100, this thing had 10 minutes, probably in that third act, that I really found myself sort of dreading. But I think it would have pushed a lot more boundaries at the time. I barely remember watching this back then. I know I went to theaters, and I know I never saw it again after that. I don't remember if I was shocked by the gothness and by the kink back then. These days, creepy, kooky, it's all kind of rather tame, but it's a weak recommend.
I think we all saw the same movie here. I had this movie on VHS. I've seen it many, many times. And again, I was having a great time listening to some of these quotes and having that pinball machine screaming, "Greed! The Mamushka!" coming at me back when I was in college playing popping quarters into that machine like nothing you'd ever seen. This movie has some great laugh lines in it, but most of the time, I didn't really laugh. I was just enjoying it. I was enjoying the mood. I was enjoying the fun of the movie. I was enjoying the lead performances we've already talked about. The energy of this movie, the way it's edited, the way it moves, the camera, as Stuart pointed out so astutely, all of these things work, but the plot is dreadful, and the resolution is clumsy. And yes, it could have been about 10 minutes shorter. 5 of those minutes could have been the opening credits instead of having nothing but smoke and that writing. Have all of that appear as the first scene is going, and that would have helped this movie immensely.
And wasn't that the Men in Black font that they put over that writing? It looked the same with the tall letters.
I think it's the Addams Family font they used again for Men in Black, right? Because this one came out way before that, 5 or 6 years beforehand. It might be the Sonnenfeld font. Who knows? Maybe that's what it's called in Windows. So I'm going to give it also a mild recommend because I had so much fun watching the movie and revisiting the movie. But let's be very clear here, folks. It's not a great movie. It's just fun to watch most of the time.
Yep, agreed. And that's good enough.
I think that's why the third act drags for me, is because it is fun to watch most of the time, but when it really becomes about the plot and they leave the sketches behind is when the film shows it's nothing but loosely glued together sketches.
Yeah, and the point you pointed out with when they're in the real world and they're stuck at the motel, that's the weakest part, that does feel a little bit draggy, even though it does have some great lines in there. You're right, that part does feel like a weight on the shoulders of the movie, because the energy of the house and the creepiness and weirdness stuff is just gone, because the real world is there. And so yeah, this movie, as we pointed out, was so successful that they decided to do a sequel 2 years later, and that's going to be our next episode in the Addams Family Retrospective, Addams Family Values.
And thank you to the donors who are listening to this. We value you very much and your support of our show. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And yes, there are 4 more Addams shows to go.
So until next time, when we pay a call on the Addams Family.
Well, Tish, the hour of parting is near. Always kinda knew it'd end up like this. Just didn't think it'd be so soon.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Well played, very amusing indeed.
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating and putting out free shows every Tuesday.
This will surely be the best investment that we have ever made.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
No matter how often you scream at them or how severely you punish them, they always beg for more.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Isn't he a lady killer?
Acquitted.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
I can honestly say that was most definitely a thing you did.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I'm sure they'll deny everything.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
I don't think you understand. I'm not locked up in here with you. You're locked up in here with me.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Have no fear. Justice shall prevail.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Raul Julia, I didn't know him from Adam when this movie came out.
Padumch.
What it was? Oh, Adam's Family. I didn't
Adam's
even
Family.
Mean
yeah.
You didn't even mean to do that.
You didn't mean the joke. Oh gosh. Oh my God.
Raul Julia.
Come on, you didn't love Kiss of a Spider Woman as a kid? Yeah, it's not that Spider Woman. No Marvel involvement.
I thought it was. I really thought it was. I got so excited when Kiss of a Spider-Woman came out.
Yeah. That prison sex scene must have been something for you.
Why aren't you interested in that? Carl Struken?
I think his name is Carol.
It is.
Played by Carol Struken? Is it Struken or Striken?
Oh, I don't know. Sure. I know it's Carol.
Yeah.
You can butcher the last name all you want, but the first name, sure. I know is Carol.
Played by Carol Struken?